Good morning. So hopefully you're here for CS3330, and I didn't find the wrong room, and somehow I got to be able to project in front of it. And as it says in the catalog, 3330 is computer architecture. So what does that mean? That's how computers are built. We're going to be kind of going through more layers of abstraction, sort of in addition to the ones you've kind of seen in the software space, right? The ones that exist in the hardware space. And you've seen a bit of this in 2150, and we're going to start by reviewing some things that you maybe are supposed to remember about 2150, but my experience teaching this class has told me it doesn't happen. And what we're thinking about is, like, we're going to say, well, you've learned languages like C or C++, which for the purposes of this course are a higher level language. If we're talking programming languages in general, no, they aren't. But for this course, that's a higher level language. That's way above what we'll be looking at a lot of the semester. And you've learned that C gets turned into assembly. And sort of the assembly language we're going to use for this course is 64-bit x86, which in theory you looked at in 2150. Look on the slide, I have the syntax. You didn't learn AT&T syntax, and that's because some tools we'll be using in our book use that syntax, so that's the one we're going to use for this course. And we're going to talk a bit about, sort of assemblies. Well, not what actually the hardware understands. We don't typically build processors which can read the letter A, then D, then D in hardware. So we have some form that's for the hardware we call machine code. And I know, there's an x86 machine code. We're not going to be using that. We're going to be using a machine code from our textbook called Y86. That's kind of simpler than x86. And this is mainly because real x86 machine code is complicated for reasons that are basically just because of the bizarre history of x86 and would take a lot of time to learn and aren't worth our time. So we have machine code that's for the hardware understand, and then we need to build hardware. So we're going to talk a bit about languages for describing hardware. So hardware, if you took courses sort of about circuits, you have gates and transistors and registers and wires to build up hardware. We're not going to be drawing circuit diagrams to design processors. That's typically not what's done in practice. Instead, we use some sort of Hoser design language that gets compiled down to something like a circuit diagram. And in this class, we're going to be using kind of a toy/teaching Hoser design language that's similar to the real ones, but simpler ways that are very relevant for us, called HCLRS, which we'll talk about a lot later in the semester. So let's just sort of go down this and talk about what we're choosing to do and why we chose this. So I have a higher level language. We're going to use C. And I'm not using C because I think you should be programming in C in this class. C in the real world. C is a very popular language, but we're using C for a particular reason. One reason is that, probably the main reason, is that you kind of already know it. That you hopefully vaguely remember doing a bunch of assignments in C++ in 2150, and C is almost a subset of C++. Strictly speaking, it's not a subset. There is C code, which is invalid C++ code. But it's pretty close to being a subset, so you already know it, in theory. Though maybe some of you will need to review pointers, or that will come up that some of you took 2150 a while ago, and all the courses in between weren't in C++, but you've seen it before. We don't need to reteach the language. And most relevantly to this class, C has a direct correspondence to assembly. Now, when I say it has a direct correspondence, that means that, we can look at C and figure out sort of what the machine would do in this direct correspondence. But you shouldn't assume that means that when you write C programs and compile them, this is actually what's happening. So there is a straightforward way of translating C to assembly, but your compiler might do something more clever. And in practice, they often do this because they think it will be faster. So even though there's maybe a direct way to do something, the compiler might say, well, that would be slow. Let me do this really clever thing and when I translate this to assembly. We're not going to be like concerned about how to do that, but I want you to be aware that, you know, when we say, oh, when you do plus equals and C, that turns into an add instruction, that's in this direct correspondence. That doesn't mean your compiler has to do that. And for this course, you'll need an environment which has a C compiler and things like that. You should have department accounts. I requested them earlier this week, so if you were registered, you should have one, or you might have one from a prior course. And this will give you access via SSH to a terminal on a department machine, or via NX, which is a remote desktop software, to a department on a machine. There are instructions off the course website, which is linked on Colab. There are also some other options. This is the officially supported option. Yes, many of you will find a way to do all your assignments on your laptop directly, without logging into a department machine, and that's fine. But if there's problems doing that, we're going to go through doing this process rather than having OTAs spend time supporting how to get a VM working on your machine when there's four other students waiting. You know, maybe if the office hours is empty, we can do that, but we're not going to, you know, prioritize getting something working on your machine versus something where we have people we can email who are paid to support these things, these remote login solutions. So as I said, the department machines are officially supported platform. Many people end up using laptops. And, you know, if you have a Linux environment, pretty much everything should work. If you have a Unix-like environment like OS X, there's some assignments which definitely won't work, but many of them will work directly on that. So, questions on sort of computing environment issues? Okay. So that's on C, having a C compiler in that sort of Unix environment, that's kind of C expects. And let's talk next about assembly. So as I mentioned, we're using x86-64 assembly, because in theory, you already know it. In practice, I found this is very well. So let's do a little warm-up here. So I have a little function in C that adds three global variables together. And I have two different pieces of assembly, which I've written in both the Intel syntax, you are probably more familiar with from 2150, and AT&T syntax, which we'll talk about later. And I promise you that those are actually equivalent, they're just different ways of writing the assembly. And I'd like you to figure out which of these are correct translations of that C function. You can discuss with your neighbors, see, think.
Thank you.
one more time? Okay, so who thinks A, correct version, B, correct, C, both of them, and D, neither of them? Okay, so anyone selected D when I volunteer? What do you think? Why do you not like any of them?
Well, like, initially, I thought it was B, but, like, since it's an
int,
doesn't have to be EAX?
Since it's an int, doesn't have to be EAX, yes. So, that's what's telling me. Otherwise, B is correct. So most of you caught the biggest problem that I see, which is people really wanting this to be not a memory address. So let's talk about what these instructions do. So, the move instruction here, it's a move of the thing at the address of X, and when we have labels in assembly, that's names of things like that you have a, so you might have like foo colon in assembly, we call foo is a label, and when we use that label in an instruction, it turns into the address that foo points to. So in this case, this is a move from the address of foo into RAX. And RAX is an 8-byte register. So this is an 8-byte move instruction, which is probably not what we mean by an int. But otherwise, it was very close. Then we have this add instruction. And what this add instruction says is that we take RAX plus Y, and we use that as a memory location, which probably isn't what we intended here. So this is taking RAX, which we just got from X, adding the address of Y to it to get a new address. So if Y was an array, this is similar to looking something up in that array at an index based on RAX. And that's nothing like what this C code does. Not even close. Like, that would require, like, an array access or a pointer to reference. None of that's going on. So this is similar to doing y of x divided by size of 1. And the other version is taking RAX, adding to it the value in memory at y. So what it turns out is that B here, this is equivalent to if we had long X, Y, Z, and long get sum with the same return statement. I'll make this actually written. Okay. So questions on what's going on here? Okay, so you have pretty good memory of assembly. The int versus long thing is really subtle, and I missed it the first time I did this exercise. Yeah, at least some memory of assembly, and we're going to go through more of it sort of as our topic next week. And also talk about some things in assembly that you didn't see in 2150 that are going to come up probably in our first assignment. Okay, so then machine code. So I mentioned that we're using this YA6 machine code, which is our textbook's sort of x86-64 subset with their own kind of way of encoding it. And the main reason we're using it is it's much simpler than the real x86-64 encoding. The reason the real x86-64 encoding is really complicated is because basically there's this chip that had like 16-bit registers, and then they built sort of a version of it which had 32-bit registers, and they decided, well, we better keep the machine code basically the same, even though the register sizes change. And also, like, they double the number of registers from 4 to 8. So, we're going to still keep the machine code basically the same. And just sort of add on support for the bigger registers. And this happened again when they went from 32 to 64 bits. And so, the machine code is really complicated. just because of that, and also because x86-64 supports lots and lots and lots of instructions, with lots and lots of ways of writing offhands. The subset we're going to be using called y86 is much smaller. And you're probably going to appreciate that, because you're going to be spending more time writing stuff in a hardware design language to implement y86 than writing y86 code. And having a little bit less to implement for you is better than having more flexibility when writing the assembly you're not going to be doing very much. And even though y86 is fairly simple, it's not nearly as simple as the IBCM you may or may not remember from 2150. Like, it has a variable length of coding, so each instruction in the machine code can take different amounts of space, and we'll talk about how to deal with that. There's multiple registers, there's a stack manipulation, there's conditional jumps, so it's more complicated than what you saw before. And I mentioned that you're going to be taking this sort of simple machine code, but not as simple as what you saw before, and implementing it sort of in a hardware design language. So we have this hardware design language, which we call HCLOS, and it's based on our textbook. And this is the part of the class where we're going to follow our textbook, which looks like this. Computer Systems and Programmers Perspective. There's also an international edition, which looks different and is fine to use. And the HCL assignments, this hardware description assignments, follow it pretty closely. The hardware description language we're going to use is not the same as the one in the textbook. The one in the textbook was a little less flexible. We'll talk about that when we get to it. But it's based on the textbook, and there's a processor design the textbook describes. The assignments are implement that processor design. So it's really helpful to have access to the textbook for that set of assignments. And we're talking about implementing a processor. We probably should talk about, well, what does a processor do? And, you know, this is kind of gone over vaguely in 2150. And sort of one view of it is that if you want a computer, we have to have something which does computation, which we'll call our CPU or processor, CPU or central processing unit. And that's going to be connected to some storage, which we'll call memory here. And there's going to be some connection. And here I have a rather old die photo of a single core processor, or two core processor probably. And I have a picture of a stick of memory that you could put in a desktop. And by die photo I mean that this is a microscope photo. The real thing is much, much smaller. And usually covered by a package that, like, is probably black on top and relatively featureless. But this is sort of what we have, and these are connected to each other, and, you know, I sort of show you what the processor looks like. Firstly, the processor, you know, does actually have storage. So, I, like, kind of talked about, oh, memory is where we store data, and the processor does the computation, but that's not strictly true. The processor is going to have some storage, because it needs to keep track of some stuff in order to do any useful computation. So one thing it needs to keep track of is what we call the program counter, or sometimes the instruction pointer, which is where's the current instruction that we're running. So we talked about machine code. Machine code is how the processor knows what to do. Well, in order to use machine code, it needs to know, well, where do I find the machine code to run? And it needs to keep track of that. So we're going to store something we call the program counter. And let's say our program counter is 4043. The processor needs to get the instruction that corresponds to that, the machine code. And most of the stuff is stored in the memory. So in order to get it, the processor is going to need to ask the memory, hey, what's the data and address 4043? And the memory is going to come back and tell it that, oh, it's this instruction here. This instruction here, in this case, is move 42 to RX. Now, it's not going to say it, move 42 to REX is like text. It's going to say it in some sort of machine code format that's more compact and easier for the processor to process, because we don't want to, like, implement text parsing in our hardware. We're going to have a simpler format, but it's going to get bytes which effectively encode this information, that is move 42 to REX. Now, for this bit to make sense, we need to know what's our X. And so we're going to have some space on the processor for storing what we call registers, which are basically sort of our scratch values that are outside of the memory for working on that. And REX is going to be one. So the processor is going to look at this instruction, it's going to have some sort of circuit that processes this and updates the storage it has for the register file to say 42. And then, well, we've done that instruction, we want to find more work to do. How is the processor going to find more work to do? Well, we're going to look at our burner counter and say, well, we've already done that. We need to go to the next thing. So we're just going to advance the burner counter to whatever is after this move. So just increased it by however long it took to encode this move. And in this example, that was 4048. And we're going to repeat this process. We're going to ask the memory, hey, what's that address 4048? And the memory is going to say, oh, it's push REX. So push, if we think about push does, remember it takes a register, puts it on the stack, and updates the stack pointer. So the process is going to have to do those instructions. And so updating the stack pointer, well, the stack pointer is part of our register file, but as for actually updating the stack, that's not going to be stored in the register file, we just have the stack pointer there. But the actual sort of main storage of things with addresses is in our memory. So we're going to have to tell the memory, hey, please set this address to 42, the value of REX. It's not really 42 because OX 42. And then we've done that push instruction. We're going to move on to the next instruction, advancing the program counter again, in this case to 404C. We're going to ask the processor, hey, what's a 404C? The processor is just going to keep running this process over and over and over again. Okay. Questions on this sort of idea of our processors doing this kind of loop where it gets some data that's machine code, processes that, does things based on that, which could involve communicating with the memory more, or might not, depending on the instruction it gets. Then it advances its program counter and gets the next piece of machine code from that and repeats the cycle.
Questions, comments?
Yes.
So just to clarify, the program counter basically says, what happens here, and then
moves
on to the next, it just keeps going? Is that the right understanding?
The program counter, it says where we are, and we just keep advancing it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, as we keep going, yes. So there are some instructions that don't appear here, like, say, jump, which change the program counter in a different way than just advancing it to the next thing. But other than that, yes, the burner counter just goes to the next thing. And it's always just what we're doing. Yeah.
And if it reaches like the end of the memory, does it go back to the
question is, what happens if the burner counter reaches the end of the memory? So in this simple model here, what would happen is that, well, if we think of how addition works on unsigned numbers, which are usually how we think of our addresses, it would wrap around to zero. In practice, probably not all the locations in the memory actually work. And we'll get into some memory addresses which don't actually work. And that'll be a problem. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so have sort of our connection from processors to memory. So let's talk a bit about the memory. And the simple way you can view the memory is that, it's an array of bytes. And commonly we're going to be including more than one byte from it. We'll talk about how that works later, which you probably remember when ending this for 2150. We definitely need to review that because it's based on my experience teaching this class before, people get confused about that, and it's going to come because, well, we have to deal with memory that's in bytes, like this. But memory is basically an array of bytes. Each element of the array has an index we call the address, and there's a byte there. And if we want to create more than one byte, we have to have some way of taking multiple bytes and putting them together. So if we're doing an 8-byte integer, we somehow have to take 8 of these bytes and put them together. We'll go through what that looks like a bit later. Now, there's something I'm missing here that we need to have, like, a useful computer. Something on this diagram that I'm missing that we need for a useful computer. Anyone catch what it is? So, I have my computer which has a processor and memory. What other component do we kind of need, or else it's not, like, really a computer? We need a user interface, some way of interacting with things outside the computer. And so our simple model of how that's going to work is we'll have something that is between our memory and the processor. I call an I/O bridge, and this somehow can talk to the memory or I/O devices. And the way this would work is that when the processor, you know, says, you know, write to OX blank, that this I/O bridge will decide, is that number assigned to memory or is it assigned to an I/O device, and will send that value one of those two places. And this is probably the simplest way you can imagine connecting I/O devices to the processor. The processor still has one way to connect to the outside world, and you know, and sometimes some addresses it uses correspond to memory, some correspond to I/O devices. But you know, it's the same idea that all the processor does is says this address, read or write it, and either that's handled by memory or an I/O device. That's kind of the simplest way we can imagine connecting a processor to things like keyboards, networks, displays. Another model, which you might see in the textbook, is that we have a separate connection to I/O devices and there's processors which kind of do both. There's a combination of these. I'm going to try to usually think of this sort of idea that we have sort of one, what we call a memory bus. That multiple things are connected to, and there's some way of deciding that some addresses on that memory bus, you know, do things with memory, some of them do things with I/O devices, and this means that we can use all of normal instructions to, like, communicate with the keyboard and so on. We just do a memory read or write, and somehow it does something with the keyboard. The textbook presents a design, which some processors do in fact use, where we have, like, a separate connection, you know, and possibly separate instructions, therefore, to talk to I/O devices. Okay. So, we have this model where we have a processor and this connection to memory, which I called sort of a memory bus, or sometimes we'll call it the bus. And let's do a little exercise here. So in this model that I showed you, let's talk about this move instruction, which takes a value at memory location hex 123400, loads it, and puts it in RAX. And when we run this instruction, my question is, how many times do we send a message in this model I just showed you from the processor to memory? Been discussed with your neighbors.
I'm going to go back to the system.
Okay. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks? Let's see. Zero times? One time? Okay, two times? Three times? Four more times? Okay, so we have consensus on, I guess, a plurality on two, with one being the next most popular answer, and some fours. So if we think about running an instruction, so our general process is first, you know, we need to get the machine code for this instruction. That the instruction initially is going to be stored over here. Here's just where we're going to have the move instruction. Somewhere over there, depending on, you know, we aren't told the question where exactly it is, but it's somewhere over there. So, we, in order to get that to the processor needs to ask for it. It's not going to be sent automatically. So, we're going to have our first communication to get the instruction. Then, once we get the instruction, the processor needs to run this instruction. And part of running this instruction is accessing memory at address 123400. That value again is somewhere here. So we have LX123400 is somewhere in the memory. It's not on the processor yet. The processor needs to get it there. It's not going to happen automatically, so it needs to ask for it. So we're going to have two communications to run this instruction. So one, part of running the instruction is actually getting the machine code. You know, and we're going to consider that part of the instruction. So some of you selected one probably kind of said, oh, that's not really part of running the instruction. That's not unreasonable. When we think of running instructions, we're going to include the part where we have to get the instruction into the processor somehow. The processor knows what it is. Because that's in fact going to be a lot of the work we're going to end up doing when we build a processor, is somehow getting the instruction there. And some of you selected three of them and said, oh, but after we run the instruction, our next thing we're going to do is get the next instruction. And that is indeed something we need to do. I would call that part of running the next instruction, not this one. But it is indeed something the processor needs to do, so you selected three because of that reasonable answer. And I was surprised no one really wanted to go like way above three, because something else you might think of is, wait a moment, when I'm requesting this value here, I'm getting 8 bytes. And it wouldn't be unreasonable to say, don't we need to get each byte separately, but that's generally not how the memory is going to work. We're going to have a way of getting a bunch of bytes at a time, at least. And while actually how I'm talking about how the memory works is a little simplified over what really happens, as we'll discuss later in the semester when we talk about something called caches. So questions on this exercise? Sort of a model of how the processor works with the bus? Yes?
Will these slides with the answers be available to us?
Question, will these slides with the answers be available? Yes, I will post them sometime later today. I don't post the slides with the answers before for obvious reasons. So let's do a little interlude on this course and logistics. So one thing talking about this course is that, you know, we're talking about building hardware, how hardware works, how assembly works, and a lot of people have complained, gosh, you know, this course is not going to be useful to me because I am never going to design a processor, which is probably true because most people don't do that. Or graduates, you know, I'm probably not going to be writing assembly, probably true, most people that do that who are graduates, why should I care about this course? And there's a few things I think would make, you know, this course useful to you, even if you're doing a quote-unquote normal software development. So one thing is that we're going to understand how hardware works in a way which is going to give you insights into how program performance happens. So if you think about program performance, you know, from what we've talked about so far, you might have this sort of model that, oh, each instruction probably takes basically the same amount of time. And, you know, if I want to make my program faster, I just want to reduce the number of instructions. And this is a fine first approximation, but there's some ways in which it is sort of very wrong. And there's kind of two things that hardware does that make this idea that I can count the number of instructions and that tells me how fast my program is very off. And they're going to be big themes this semester. So one of them is parallelism. So hardware, because it has multiple components, can easily do multiple things at the same time. And fast processors, in fact, do this. So fast processors don't actually follow the model I just told you and run one instruction, then move on to the next. They actually run a lot of instructions in sort of an overlapping way. And we're going to discuss how that works. And knowing how that works will let you write faster programs. And why is this? Because, well, the hardware can only actually kind of run multiple instructions at the same time if, you know, the instructions are sufficiently independent of each other. And so by knowing that the hardware is doing this, you can write your programs to give the hardware more work it can do in parallel and make your programs faster. And another big thing hardware does that it doesn't follow this one instruction per one unit of time thing is what we call is caching, is that accessing recently used data is faster. And that's because another way in that which that best model I told you was wrong is that the hardware, usually the processor rather, usually tries avoiding talking to the memory all the time, because it turns out that talking to the memory is relatively slow compared to accessing storage that is on the processor. So the processor is going to store recently used things or things it thinks you're going to use soon in faster storage that is on the processor itself, so it doesn't have to send as many messages to the memory. And this is actually a huge difference. So accessing those things on the processor is like 1,000-ish times, 100 to 1,000 times faster than talking to the memory. And, you know, typically this just works for you, but your code affects how efficient this is. That if you can figure out how to structure your accesses to make sure the processor can keep the things you're accessing in that fast storage, your program will run a lot faster. So these are both things that US sort of higher level programmers can take advantage of. And these are ways of making your program performance faster that are complementary to things you may be learning in other courses. So if you, you know, learn about Big O stuff, all this Big O stuff, this is stuff you can do in addition to Big O stuff to make your program run fast in practice. So questions about sort of our high-level overview of parallelism caching? So another thing we'll talk about is what compilers actually do. So you have kind of a simple idea, oh, compilers make assembly. We're going to learn a little more about sort of the constraints compilers have and the process of converting sort of assembly and C code into sort of an actual runnable program and how that's laid out, how it chooses memory locations, and so on. And this might be helpful because, you know, if you know more about how does a process compiler rather go from like C code to an executable file, or how does even the assembly go from assembly code to an executable file, you know, that will help you understand like weird compiler and linker errors, like what's going on, what are symbols, you know, how is the what happens to global variables, how does it decide where those go? And also for debugging applications should be helpful for that. And another thing we're going to talk about is how processors deal with, you know, programs behaving in weird ways. So we're going to talk about the processor support for operating systems. And a big part of that is dealing with things like whatever program accesses memory it's not supposed to. And so, part of the things we're going to learn in this class is like, what's a set fault? Like, what's really happening in the processor? Why does it only happen sometimes when you go out of bounds in an array and not all the time? Like, what's causing that? You know, what does the operating system do to interact with programs? You know, what, how does, you know, how does it work when you actually ask to read something from the keyboard? You know, what's going on there in, with the processor and the other programs? And also, you know, things you want to know for, like, writing OSs, where most of what OSs are doing are keeping programs from getting in trouble. And to do that, as we'll learn, there's a lot of hardware support to help OSs do that. So, for example, one of the big things OSs want to do is keep programs from accessing memory they're not supposed to. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about how the hardware helps with that, because if the OS was just doing it without special hardware support, it would be really hard. Questions on these topics we hope you'll find useful, even if you don't care about baking hardware. Okay, so some logistics for this course. As you probably noticed if you were looking at notifications from Sys and the like, well, there was a co-instructor for this class. Serge, can you... My plan is that we'll be splitting the lectures in some way, and hopefully, you know, having him take some of the work so I can have spend time on the other course I'm also teaching. Serge is a computer engineering PhD student, and so has done more stuff with hardware than I actually have. So some logistical things. So lectures and lab attendance. We're not going to be checking whether you attend lecture or not. I think it's probably a good idea. But lectures are recorded. Remote submissions of labs is possible. If you're not attending lectures, if you're relying on lecture recordings, I strongly recommend things which I think are probably obvious, but probably worth stating. You have a regular schedule of watching them, so it actually happens. That you pause and try to answer questions rather than just, you know, moving on waiting for the answer. And if you have questions yourself, writing them down so you don't forget them after you've watched, and like actually asking any questions you have afterwards on Piazza, Office Hours, Lab, etc. So, coursework. We have labs, which are going to be full credit if some threshold amount is completed. So, for all the labs, there's some amount of stuff we expect to be completed that is slightly less than the whole lab, but not that much less. The intent is that you can reliably get 100% if you work on the lab time, though, as I said, you can submit them remotely. And if you submit them remotely, we obviously do not know how long you actually worked, so we're going to look at what you submitted, not like say, oh, you definitely worked enough time. You know, the intent is that the threshold matches how much time you need, but it's not going to be perfect. Collaboration on labs is permitted. If you work with other people, that's fine. Go ahead, especially if you work with other people in person a lot. And labs are due 11:59 p.m. on the lab days. There are homework assignments. For the most part, the homework assignments are introduced by the lab. So there will be a lab, and the homework assignment that follows that will be on a related topic, and the lab will have been helpful. The homework assignments are not collaborative assignments. They're to be included individually. And they're due 4:59 p.m. the lab day. That is before the first lab. The intent of this policy is that you don't go to the lab and only ask questions about the homework. There are also weekly quizzes starting after next week. And we'll go through the logistics of them closer to when they're assigned. And there will be a final exam, which will be in person at our scheduled exam time. questions about coursework? Yes.
What is the
waiting? Sorry, what is the
waiting?
What is the waiting? It is on the policies page on the website. I think I have a slide for it. But. There's a textbook, which, as I said, for the 8 hardware description language assignments, I strongly recommend having. You follow it less closely for other stuff. And as I said, if the international edition's fine, and you know, we're not assigning exercises from it or anything like that. So generally, we try to have lectures and labs and homework sort of be in sync, but sometimes we'll cover something in lecture in the homework or lab because of how many assignments we have and the schedule works out. Won't be until a little later. Just letting you know that might happen. So just because it doesn't seem like we immediately have something in lecture being covered in the homework doesn't mean it won't happen. So quizzes, they're going to be linked off the course website. They're going to be released Thursday night and due Tuesday before lecture. And they'll be based on the lecture material for the past week. And the two lowest quiz grades will be dropped. And they're released Thursday night and not immediately after lecture, because if we don't get to things I expect to get to a lecture, I might need to revise the quiz. So it has need to build in some time to do that. The quizzes are untimed, open notes, open book, but to be completed individually, please. And you can ask us questions about the lecture material. Don't ask like TAs and me questions about, or like our co-instructor questions about like the quiz question exactly. Like, we're not going to answer that. But if you want to say, what was this lecture about? You know, what would change in this exercise if we changed that number? You know, that's perfectly fine. But what's going on in the textbook here? You know, those sorts of questions are fine. Asking the quiz question, not fine. And also, of course, like asking the quiz question on Stack Overflow, not fine. So, late policy. If you have an exceptional circumstance, contact us. We can often do things about that, sickness, family emergencies, etc. The no questions asked late policy for homeworks, if it's 0 to 48 hours late, there's no sliding scale here, it is 10% off. If it is 48 to 72 hours late, is 15% off. Otherwise, no credit. We'll grade it, but you won't get credit for it. For quizzes and labs, late submissions are generally not allowed. Exceptional circumstances, talk to me. The main reason why is that we release answers sometimes for quizzes and labs, especially for quizzes. And for quizzes, we'll often talk about them during this lecture, so we can't like really let you submit a quiz after discussing the answer in detail in the lecture. And for labs, sometimes we release the answers to help with the next homework, and we want to do that promptly because we want people to start the homework on an appropriate time. Okay, so for getting help, for non-real time help, there's Piazza. Labs are in person, and you can get help there. Of course, that will be manned by TAs. And there will be office hours to be specified in the calendar. They're not very filled in right now. Like, I will have office hours next week, but they're not in the calendar because I need to figure out what meetings I'm scheduling them around. Some of them will be in person, and some of them will be remote, as indicated on the calendar. So we'll have a mix of them. There for remote ones and possibly some in-person ones, there's an online queue for getting help. And our plan is that remote times will either be late in the day or lower demand times, and the other times will be in-person, but it will depend on TA availability and stuff. And then they said for remote office hours and summer hosted office hours, we have an online queue. The queue we have is sorted by the last time people were helped, with possibly the first few slots being first come, first served. My hope is that the queue doesn't matter because we have so many TAs available that you can all get help without waiting very long. But sometimes everyone will decide that they can't actually ask for help with the assignment until 9 p.m. on Tuesday, and that won't happen. In which case, we have this sort of compromise, and then sort of the main goals here are I want to spread out the help among more students, and I want to make it so students who, like, join the queue the previous night or stay on the queue all the time don't get an advantage, because, you know, versus students who, like, only go on the queue when they have a question kind of formed. But my hope, of course, is that the queue doesn't really matter because the waits are long.
Okay, so I think that's... Do I don't have a... I think that's all my logistics. Questions about logistics in relation to this slide. Yeah?
You said that the lectures might run a little bit ahead of the labs and homework. Do you know, like, kind of maximum, like, if you lecture on something, you should expect to see in a week or two, or could it be longer?
Question, do I know the maximum sort of gap between lectures and homeworks?
Yeah.
Probably a week or two. It would be the maximum. It will depend on how things go this semester, because we may need to adjust the lecture schedule, of course. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So, let's talk a bit about our memory here. And I said that it's an array of bytes, so I can sort of draw our array of bytes here. And in this class, a byte is 8 bits. And it's just bytes, so you might say, well, some of these are instructions, some of these are like things instructions access. How do we know the difference? The only way we know the difference is what the processor does when it gets the value. And here, I've drawn this array of bytes where at the bottom of my slide, I have the lowest address, and at the top of the slide, I have my highest address. I can also draw this in the other way, and it's the same stuff. Just two different ways of drawing things. And in practice, you'll see both. So pay attention to labels if you're looking at sort of diagrams of memory. So, mention that it's in the right place, we have to get values that are more than one byte. So, let's say here I have some C code where I'm getting the address 42000, and 42000 is here. And I'm getting an int from it, and on the systems we're going to use, ints are four bytes. So I can't just get 42000, that's not 4 bytes. I need to get 4 boxes of my memory. And what we're going to do is when we start have address 42000, we're always going to get the consecutive addresses of 42001, 2, and so on. So these are the bytes that we're going to somehow turn into an int. And when turning these 4 bytes into an int, we have 2 choices that make sense. One choice we can make is that we can say that the byte at the lowest address, the one we started at, is going to be the least significant part, is going to be where the ones place is. In which case, we get this hex 03020100. Another choice we could make is that it's going to be where the highest place is, and the ones place is going to be at the highest address. 0001, 0203 is the number we get there. And there are real machines that use both of these options. The top option is called Little Endian, and the way I remember that is the least significant byte has the lowest address. So the first byte, the one at the at number we started with, is the littlest part, versus Big Endian, where that's the biggest part. And by least significant, you should think of least significant as closer to the ones place, and most significant as further from the ones place. And in this class, we are always going to use little endian, because that's what actually 664 is chosen, so that's what we're going to use. But both of them are there. And this is a decision we have to make because we have these four different bytes which all have their own addresses. So a common thing people want to do is they want to also make this decision when we're talking about values in, say, registers. But in a register, I have no way of asking for, you know, byte 3 of RAX. There's not a way to do that. There's no instruction which does that. I can, like, ask to take RAX divided by something, or RAX shifted, or with the bits changed in certain ways, but I don't have a way of indexing my, you know, byte numbers in my registers. So endian this doesn't apply to registers because I don't have addresses for my registers. I just have, no, it's RAX or EAX or something like that. I don't have a way of specifying subsets of the registers otherwise, or even the subsets have numbers. But with memory, I have that all the time. That I have this 4-byte value, and I can actually access the individual parts separately with numbers. And that's why we have to make this little versus big endian decision. So questions about endianness? What is the snippet on the left? Wait.
Is that big, middle, or big?
The question is this little or big lighter? So endian this is only when we have to somehow combine different values into one number. In this diagram here, in this picture of memory here, I just, that doesn't come up, right? I have a table, and there's no decision about is the table, you know, how do I combine parts of the table into numbers, right? And I guess the source of confusion there is that, is that often people kind of think of endianness as, do I write it kind of, which part do I write first? And I'm going to try to emphasize that we don't talk about endianness unless we have, like, addresses for the individual parts. And in the case of this diagram of memory, like, there's nothing saying that it makes that this is first because it's on top of my slot. And in fact, I have an address to know that, well, it has that number FFFFFF. That's the number it has. I don't need to decide whether it's first or second in some other way. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yes?
So for the address, like if it was theoretically not like sorted, it would be like big endian in terms of it's not FPFFFFFF, right?
Question, if this list of addresses wasn't sorted?
Well, like, is it currently laid out in big endian not in, because otherwise it'd be
the question is, because I'm starting with the biggest address, would I say that this table of my memory addresses is laid out in big endian? I would not say that, because the way we define endianness here is based on what part has the lowest address and what part has the highest address. So the endianness is how the addresses interact with what's in the ones place, basically. And with this memory, we don't have that decision. So I'd say the ending of this is irrelevant. Does that answer your question? Okay, so we use little endian, yes. So, unless otherwise specified, we're using little endian this semester. Other questions? Okay, so let's do little exercises. I'm going to go through this code because. So I have code here, I have a buffer of 8 bytes. So I've just drawn out sort of a pictorial representation of that buffer. And I have two 32-bit unsigned integers as value 1 and value 2. And I get pointers to them and convert those pointers to individual characters. And so because of this is little endian, those pointers are going to point to the byte with the lowest address, which is because we're only also going to be the ones place byte. And then what I do with that is I copy byte by byte these values into the buffer. So if we look at what's happening here, that I'm taking value 1 and I'm copying it byte by byte into the first 4 bytes of the buffer. That's what this first line here does. And then I'm taking value 2, then copying it byte by byte into the next 4 bytes of the buffer. That's what this second line here is going to do. And you can see I have this for loop that goes 4 times, so I'm copying, you know, from the first byte of value 1 into the first byte of the buffer, and the first byte of value 2 into the fourth byte of the buffer, and the second byte of value 1 into the second byte of the buffer, second byte of value 2 into the fifth byte of the buffer, and so on. And then after I've done that, I copy from the buffer back into value 1, starting at index 1, because I plus 1 here is going to be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So I'm copying these bytes here into value 1. And the question's asking, what is that value? So I'll give you some time to work through that. You can check with the neighbor. I would recommend writing things down because I certainly did.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Okay, so given where we are on time, we'll just see what do you think answers are. Do you think it's A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, something else? Okay, so we have a real split. So the answer I got was G. If you got D, you'll see you just forgot the step at the end that we're interpreting value 1 as a little endian number at the end. We'll see. So I have an explanation slide here. So what happens is initially value 1 is, this is how we wrote it out, sort of in C. In the number, we have our 7, 8 as byte 0, 5, 6 is byte 1, 3, 4 is byte 2, 1, 2 is byte 3, taking advantage of the fact that sort of hex has this nice correspondence to bits and bytes. And we have a similar translation, F0, then DE, then BC, then 9A, for value 2. We copy that into the buffer. So we end up sort of just copying byte by byte. So we end up with just those bytes in a buffer, like you see there. So 7, 8 at index 0, 5, 6 at index 1, and so on. And then F0 at index 4, DE at index 5, and so on. And then we copy from 1 to 4, 1, or 1 inclusive to 5 exclusive, into value 1. And what we end up with is that value 1, if we look at its bytes, byte 0 is 5, 6, byte 1 is 3, 4, byte 2 is 1, 2, byte 3 is F0, then we have to interpret that as a little endian number again. That's, I ask you for what value 1 is and not for the bytes, not for a list of the bytes in value 1. And when we interpret anything as any sequence of bytes as a number, a little endian, we have to say the ones place is the lowest address. The lowest address is 5, 6, so that's where the ones place. Questions? How I process? Yes.
So it starts out as big endian.
So in C, when we write a number like 100, the one place is right on the same street. Does that answer your question?
Yes.